Women on the Line, produced at 3CR, acknowledges the people of the Kulin Nations, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the lands from which we broadcast. We pay respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation, and we recognise their unceded sovereignty. Welcome back to another episode of Women on the Line, a national feminist current affairs program produced and presented by a range of women and gender non-conforming broadcasters from 3CR Community Radio in Naarm, Melbourne. We're broadcast across the continent on the Community Radio Network. I'm your host for today, Scheherazade Bloul. So today we're going to be talking about critical minerals. And I think there's a lot of confusion when we're thinking about what critical minerals are. We hear critical minerals being spoken about by President Trump, by the Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong, by the Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, by the Defence Minister Richard Marles, but also by CEOs of mining companies and clean energy companies. So what on earth are critical minerals? You know, critical minerals aren't like a bound set thing. They were first created, so the first critical minerals list was created during World War I by the US to secure materials for weapons and machineries that were running scarce during the war. That list, since that time, more than 100 years ago now, has steadily expanded. What counts as critical is shaped less by geology and more by shifting industrial needs and war economies. And now, critical minerals have become one of the central pressure points that we can see in the news and in global politics. And the Australian state is now being positioned as one of the key suppliers for this US-led security and technology order. Just to encase it with what's been happening for the past couple of years, we'll just go back to AUKUS, which was signed in September 2021. And even though that was framed around nuclear-powered submarines, we know, and as we've kind of discussed on our show before, that AUKUS is really about Pillar 2, which is this broader industrial partnership, which is upscaling the supply chains between Anglophone countries, even though other countries are coming on board, of course. But the central countries are obviously Australia, the UK and the US AUKUS. By 2022, which was just a few months after the announcement, AUKUS working groups were already identifying vulnerabilities in the supply of rare earths, lithium and high purity silicon. And these are the same minerals that are used in missiles, radar systems, semiconductors and also renewable technologies. So from 2023, Canberra and Washington intensified their coordination on critical minerals policy as fears around China's dominance in processing and refining became more and more politicised. And it's not so much about the geological scarcity, as we'll discuss in the show. There's lots of critical minerals. It's more of a supply chain dependence built through decades of offshoring a lot of the production lines. And so now this has opened up the door for Australia to present itself as a really secure, friendly and critical minerals powerhouse for the AUKUS bloc and for US industry, mostly war industries. This all kind of culminates in October 2025, when the US and Australia signed a major critical minerals and rare earths framework, committing about US $8.5 billion to co-develop supply chains, expand processing capacity, and integrate Australian production into US commercial and defense industries. And this is part of a wider push of re-engineering supply chains away from China and into aligned states like Australia. Today, we're going to be tracing how all this fits together, the manufactured scarcity behind these minerals, the capitalist and military logics that are driving the push, and how extraction continues to unfold on unceded Aboriginal land, while being wrapped in the language of national security and clean energy. To help us do this, our guest for today is Mercedes Zanka, who is a researcher and fellow broadcaster here on 3CR for a show, A Friday Night Rave, focusing on the military-industrial complex and Australia's role within it. Mercedes is also part of Renegade Activists, who do really important and really cool work in investigating the arms industry. What are critical minerals and how are they involved in militarization?
Yeah, so critical minerals are, well, in the Australian context, really came into the fold in like the 2010s. Critical minerals have been, you know, on earmarked for defence and also for a large part of the capitalist economy for a long time. But I guess the critical minerals, in 2016, the assessment of critical minerals that was given to the White House, and this is a quote, it said that those that have a supply chain that is vulnerable to disruption and that serve an essential function in the manufacture of a product, the absence of which would cause significant economic or security consequence. So within critical minerals, the Australian critical minerals list, there's 31 minerals that are considered critical. Within that, there are rare earth elements, of which there are 17 as their own subcategory. So it's quite a lot more than 31. So the Australian government's definition of critical minerals in its 2023 to 2030 critical minerals strategy is that they're critical minerals of metallic or non-metallic materials that are essential to our modern technologies, economies and national security, and whose supply chains are vulnerable to disruption. Risks of disruption of critical mineral supply chains are heightened when mineral production or processing is concentrated in particular locations, facilities or companies. Which is kind of funny because that's the nature of capitalism. But I think that when we're talking about, you know, something like rare earths, it's not that they're actually rare. They're going to be plentiful in the environment and critical minerals, but it's really about that the development of scarcity, which capitalism rests upon. And so the creation of supply chain risk and vulnerability in the Australian and US context, in particular with AUKUS and the new deals that we've seen, is that at present, China currently has a monopoly on rare earth and critical minerals production, processing 90% of rare earths, and so that's that concentration that we're seeing, and the disruption of the supply chains in terms of having export bans and restrictions on particular minerals that are really crucial. And so, I guess there's critical minerals that are essential for everything from our phones, renewable energy technologies, which is the Australian government has really pushed to kind of paint these critical minerals as really necessary only for renewable energy, because that's much easier to sell to a population. But we also know that these critical minerals are absolutely essential for the development of weapon systems, from the precision guiding systems, the sensor suites, rare earth battery magnets, vanadium for battery storage, and titanium. And so, you know, just in terms of their absolute necessity in weapon systems, there's like the every F-35 fighter jet requires 400 kilos of rare earth elements, and that's not including the other critical minerals that are within that. The Virginia class submarine requires just over 4 tons of these for each. And so when we're thinking about the critical minerals list, which in the Australian context falls under the defence and strategic goods list, so it is already within a policy framework of defence, but when you look at the Australian government sort of saying that it's necessary for energy transition, which is true, but really focusing on that and the defence and weapon systems, the national security is always kind of said there. When they say national security, this is what they mean. It's for weapon systems and ensuring those supply chains for the development of those weapon systems. And I think it's really interesting in the latest when Anthony Albanese met with Donald Trump and signed this latest critical minerals deal. It's kind of the first time that the Australian government has really at the forefront mentioned defence. And in fact, you know, Albanese's press release in regards to that critical minerals deals really prioritised defence and didn't actually mention renewable energy transmission whatsoever. And I think it's really important to note the CSIRO's, the energy critical minerals that are necessary for the renewable energy transition. There are 18 of the critical minerals that are considered energy critical minerals of a list of 31. And so I think that that's important to note, that all of the critical minerals that have been told that are all necessary for renewable energy transition. There's only 18 of them. So there are more critical minerals on that list that have other uses and necessities for the global military machine.
Because of the dual use, which means that production of technologies that are for civilian and military purposes, these lines can get a bit blurred. And so, and some of the technologies are like literally the same technologies. So how do you differentiate at the source level, which is the minerals mm-hmm. that are used in the production of these technologies? How do you differentiate the different ones for different purposes? Or you can't?
It's really hard to, because I think the dual use is a really important framing. And, you know, dual use, they do exist. Yes, okay, you'd need it for a battery for a car, for electric vehicles. You need cobalt to be able to make a phone touchscreen. So there is a lot of crossover in that, and so being able to determine. But what we do know is that these minerals, while, yes, they are necessary for renewable energy production and manufacturing, and but they are, some of them are also absolutely necessary for the development of weapon systems. And so, yeah, that dual use lens upon which we place it is that is the mechanism which allows these minerals to be mined under both for the economy, renewable energy economy, but also under the guise of national security. And so I think when we're thinking about national security, what that also allows is like the national security framework under free trade agreements means that economically, like it is more difficult for the Australian government to fund projects that are within that coherence of the free trade agreements. However, if it's under it's got a national security exception, it means that the government can fund these projects under the guise of national security and put money into the development of these projects because they're necessary for national security, and rare earth elements and critical mineral elements. We know the Australian government has been given money and given chop-outs to mining companies and resource extraction companies forever. But, you know, as we're entering a new mining boom critical minerals mines and neodymium and praseodymium in particular in the way of Arafura Resources and also Astron Donald Rare Earth Project, that there is a mechanism for the Australian government to give money over to these mining companies and to develop the policy frameworks under a national security framework such as AUKUS to allow for that more flexible trade in these critical minerals. And I think that, you know, the AUKUS framework of the license-free environment in January of 2024 for the Australia was classified as a domestic source for particular products. And so when we think about critical minerals as necessary for defence and national security, which has been now overtly stated by Anthony Albanese, and the US has been is much more transparent around the necessity of these minerals for defence. And I guess also coupling that with the geopolitical context of the hegemonic powers of China and the US, you know, kind of in a consistent battle with each other, it's kind of these minerals have become a bit of a bargaining chip. But the policy frameworks through AUKUS Pillar 2 and also the classifying as Australia as a domestic source means that these minerals can now come coupled under these policies in order to allow environmental red tape to be cut, increase access to land, stolen Aboriginal land, and to create a more free flow environment, which is kind of the goal of the AUKUS, and a big part of the AUKUS framework is to make the US, the UK and Australia and other allies, you know, this is increasingly, you know, quote unquote allies, as a more interoperable military system. And, you know, the submarines are kind of that part of that, but of course the AUKUS submarines are never going to come. It's actually like renegade activists have always had the position that AUKUS Pillar 2 is the really big policy framing that is necessary. And so increasingly we're going to see not only interoperability but interchangeability which is the language is there's been a shift in the language in terms of talking about US and UK and Australian militarism towards being interchangeable rather than just interoperable.
And you're listening to Mercedes Zanka speaking to us about the military push behind the critical minerals industry. Across these stolen lands, now called Australia, you have been listening to Women on the Line. We highlight a range of gender non-conforming and women voices, and we're broadcast on the Community Radio Network. So the US first passed these laws in the end of 2023, which was to make like a sphere between the UK, the US and Australia of free trade, which includes IP and knowledge transfer in technology production. And then the UK and Australia followed suit with a few changes in some key acts around defence. What I find particularly interesting is like this key change in one of the acts, which is supplying information to like a foreign entity, AUKUS information to a foreign entity, which could capture, like let's say it's like a defence company or a technology company that has like an AUKUS contract or something. So they have to hire... It has to be only people within AUKUS who are citizens of AUKUS, so Australia, US and the UK. And if you pass information on a specific project to someone who's a foreign national, which could be an employee, mm-hmm. that would now be deemed illegal. So there's like a specific racialization process being legalized right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you're shaking yep. your head. Yeah.
yeah.
Not in your head. So
there absolutely is. Yeah.
There's a number of huge shifts since AUKUS, critical minerals, for example, now just being like out in the open, that this is like for military purposes. And we can see this with some recent contracts funded by the Department of War in the US with Australian companies like Nova Minerals, who are now opening mining operations in Alaska. Mm-hmm. And that's directly a $44 million US dollar grant that they received from the Department of War. And that's like a mineral company that's headquartered here in Caulfield, right?
Yeah.
Maybe we can talk about some specific deals and shifts, like you were saying in the discourse, this shift towards old school colonialism, which Gaza has kind of laid bare.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to go back to your point of just very quickly about the AUKUS legislation and providing information to foreign nationals. And I think that does embed a racial element and racist element within the policy. And I think it's important to note here, I think that the free trade was the Defence Control Trade Amendment Bill, which allows a licence-free environment between the US and the UK and Australia. Which includes IP, but in providing that information, there's also a list, and off the top of my head, I can't remember how many countries are on it, of like, oh, it's okay to provide that information to countries on this list. Yeah. And, you know, and you look at it and it's just blatantly obvious about like the imperial and colonial elements that are embedded into this legislation. And I think that really goes to show also broadly when we look at the context of Australia of a rise of far-right ideology and anti-immigration sentiment. And it's like it's really laying bare the realities of what this country is and embedding it in it and how the social elements that we're kind of seeing is now we've got a major policy that is embedding this, and it always has been embedded because the very nature of this country built on genocide of First Nations people. But it's laying bare. It's a bit of a tangent, but...
it's literally part of the question. So this is just like a kind of a example here on this continent. But, yeah, it's like there's this huge shift in the kind of global order where, okay... it's still running as usual, but with this old school violence that has been only visible in certain places in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. And the normalization of that violence, you know. And so I guess in terms of the second part of the question, which was, you know, looking at where these minerals are and kind of where they end up. I mean, we can talk about a couple of them. The major players in Australia that are mining here would, you know, there's quite a few of them, but I would guess, you know, focusing on Lynas Rare Earths and maybe Arafura Resources So Arafura Resources was one of the companies that Albanese mentioned that is located just northeast of Mpwantwa, Alice Springs, and they're Nolans Bore neodymium and praseodymium mine. So they've really been supported to the tune of like over $1 billion by the Australian government to develop this project. And that's happened through the Australian government, National Reconstruction Fund Corporation, through the Australian government. They've also, Arafura Resources and the Nolans Bore project is 10% owned by Gina Reinhart. And it's been in development for about 25 years. So in 2019, Arafura Resources signed a letter of intent with USA Rare Earths, and that was to send heavy rare earth element concentrate from Nolans Bore, that's Nolans Bore's facility, to USA Rare Earths plant in Colorado. And those samples first started to be sent in about 2020. So if you think about in the time of that was when Scott Morrison was in power, and Scott Morrison was, you know, doing deals with Trump just prior to AUKUS. In 2019, USA Rare Earths and its joint venture partner, Texas Mineral Resources, submitted a tender for USA Department of Defense funding, which is now Department of War, funding to build a heavy rare earth separation plant. Just recently, I guess, in terms of there's light rare earth separation and processing, and then there's heavy rare earths. There's differences in those, and heavy rare earth separation is really only happens in China at the moment. But whereas Lynas, just recently, Lynas has just acquired funding and to build a heavy rare earth separation plant in the US. And so Lynas is another Australian company, which currently it's in Kalgoorlie on Wongai country. They have the Mount Weld Mount Weld. It's also a neodymium and praseodymium mine and a mixed rare earth carbonate processing facility. So Lynas have opened a light rare earth processing facility that was in November last year, but also Lynas sends most of what it extracts from its Mount Weld facility to Malaysia. And I think there's, you know, obvious, this is a really environmentally labour-intensive process that has like got a lot of, and so, you know, processing facilities of where these processing facilities and the bypassing of those laws of where that happens is a really important part of looking at what this means. So, you know, in Malaysia, it allows Lynas to bypass specific labour laws or environmental laws, which might not happen here in Australia, but the US, so we know, are also willing to bypass those environmental laws. And so what that means in terms of geopolitically of where these places are spread out and where these companies are extracting labour and wealth and profit from other places globally. So back to Arafura Resources. It's kind of it feels like I'm jumping around a little bit here in terms of the companies, but I think it's just indicative that they're, in terms of this, there is a lot of crossover in the way that the companies operate, because, you know, just like any with capitalist venture, you rub shoulders. And so Arafura Resources has a number of offtake agreements, and they're currently trying to secure offtake for the rest of their product. So they have an offtake agreement with Hyundai, Kia, and a company, they've just signed a new one with a company called Traxys. So Traxys is a minerals distributor, I guess you could say. And so they kind of get a whole bunch of product and then distribute that as the market dictates. And I just want to mention here that allegedly an investigation by Global Witness that came out just earlier in April this year alleges that Traxys has gotten conflict coltan from Rwanda. The company, of course, denies that, but I think it was about 280 kilograms of conflict coltan, and that's what the Global Witness report alleges. Traxys denies it, but in terms of further investigation, that's not happened. And so Arafura Resources has just signed an offtake agreement with this company. Arafura Resources has also signed for the gas for the to operate its facility at Nolans Bore. And so in March this year, at the end of March this year, Arafura Resources signed a letter of intent with Tamboran Resources. Tamboran is, and that was to progress discussions for potential gas supply from Tamboran's Beetaloo Basin assets to Arafura's Nolans Rare Earth Project. So perhaps listeners will be aware of Tamboran's involvement in fracking of the Beetaloo Basin and the environmental impacts of Tamboran's projects that it happened. And I would encourage listeners to have a look. But this is the kind of, you know, in terms of, you know, down the supply chain of where you're needing to get resources to run these things. It kind of goes down the line of exploitation and environmental destruction and, you know, of projects that the fracking of the Beetaloo Basin has been fought by TOs and communities out there for a long, long time. And so where that connection is in regards to that, this is where it's a non-binding letter of intent. And so I think that this is a really important point to raise as we're seeing these projects progress.
And that was researcher and fellow broadcaster on 3CR, Mercedes Zanka. And so that's all we have time for today. We'd love to hear any comments or thoughts you might have about the program. So please send us an email to womenontheline@gmail.com, or you can give us a call at 3CR on 03 9419 8377. Women on the Line is a national feminist current affairs program, and it's produced and presented by a range of women and gender non-conforming broadcasters from 3CR in Melbourne. We broadcast across the continent on the Community Radio Network. We have funding support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. The theme music that you hear on our shows is by Ripley Kavara. And all our programs can be downloaded from 3cr.org.au/womenontheline. You can also listen back to any of our shows on your favourite podcasting app. I'm Scheherazade Bloul, and tune in again next week for more Women on the Line content.